we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense, in which we start to look at stories from different perspectives. The first story, which is often the simple linear approach, to actually the more complex, messy story, which is where the real learning happens. And today, what I've got is Justin Featherstone, who I met at a philosophical breakfast club arranged by Al Helliwell and his team down in Exeter about 4 weeks ago now. And he told a really powerful story. And actually, just the way of storytelling and getting on the stage was, this is cool, and grab people's attention. And it was a really powerful story and linked with multiple stories. So, Justin, tell people a little bit about who you are, what do you do, how did you get to where you are, and where people might be able to find you in the real space and the digital space.
So I'm a leadership consultant. I also do some occasional university lecturing at universities of both Exeter and Ljubljana. I'm an outdoor pursuits instructor, and I'm also an expedition leader. And I've been doing that since about 2008. But before that, I spent the best part of 18 years as an army officer in the Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment, where so much of my grounding and understanding of leadership, operating in different both cultures and environments, and actually where I really got my taste for leading expeditions and where I became qualified to do so.
Excellent. So do you have a website? Do you have an email that people can get hold of you on?
So email Denali UK, that's Delta Echo November, Alpha Lima India UK at yahoo.co.uk. Found on all places, X, LinkedIn, Blue Sky, and my website is Justin Featherstone MC.
Excellent. So I was interested in that Denali UK. So you obviously done a bit of stuff up in Alaska. And have they, and I don't know what's going on in the States, there was something about the name of Denali changing as... what's going on with that?
So for years, it was known by North American and European mountaineers as Mount McKinley. But its Aleut name, so the First Nation name is Denali, always has been, the great one. And locals and Alaska mountaineers, and most people have referred it to Denali for decades now. So I think it's probably...
It's not what I'm thinking of then. I thought it'd been changed to something else. So yeah, I know it's Denali more than McKinley. So no, that's cool. So where we're coming from for this this sort of podcast is understanding a first story. And you told a really powerful story on the stage in Exeter. And we've had a little bit of a discussion about that. So how would you... tell this first story about what happened.
Well, I would take us back to June 2005. And to put into perspective, that's about 8 months after my return from commanding a company of 153 soldiers on a very busy tour of southern Iraq. And so I was both psychologically and physically worn down to a point of extreme. And for this period, we are in the French Alps. We're on the Mont Blanc Massif. And I'm the director and the leader of a program to qualify 8 young soldiers, including a couple of young officers, in being what we call alpine proficient mountaineers. So, if you like, proficient to operate together with those of a similar qualification in the alpine environment. A 2-week program, if you like, climbing a number of 4,000 meter peaks and getting people used to the techniques of operating in that environment. So in the day in question, we're now actually towards the end of our program. And so we only have one more day to go. And we've actually climbed, if you like, our penultimate peak, Mont Blanc du Tacle. And everyone's really excited. So we've just nailed our, if you like, our final 4,000 meter peak, a satellite peak of Mont Blanc, before we returned to the hut for the night. And then we set off in the very early hours of the next morning to do the Traversée de Mont Blanc. So to climb three mountains, including Mont Blanc itself. The idea being that on the summit of Mont Blanc, I would give each of those soldiers and officers their certificate of graduation. And so there's a real buzz in the air, as you can imagine. It's been a hard but joyous couple of weeks. And we're now skipping down the mountainside in the early afternoon. It's quite a sunny day. But it's quite cold, but the wind's quite low. And you can even see the fractals of the ice spinning off people's crampons as we rush down on our three ropes. And I remember distinctly that there was a real feeling of a contentment and that little buzz of excitement for what was about to come the next day, when there was a noise that changed everything instantaneously. A noise that is so visceral that I can still feel it in my bones today. I had a very small amount of time, half a second perhaps, to look over my shoulder, and I saw this enormous plume of, if you like, it's smoke, but of course it's not. It's powdered snow and ice falling down as a serac fall triggers a massive avalanche. A serac fall is a fall of blocks of ice off a north face. And within moments, that pressure wave has knocked me from my feet and I'm tumbling amongst a maelstrom of ice and snow, thinking this can only end one way, just because of the sheer volume of tens of thousands of tons that I've now found myself in, along with the two other people on my rope. And then when I came to, I found myself in a position that I simply could not have envisaged. It was beyond comprehension and something I'd never encountered in reading or through other people's experiences at all. And what I found was I was hanging upside down with my feet frozen into an icy roof across a huge yawning crevasse. And my hands, if you like, laid out before me as I looked straight down into the dark chasm, down to perhaps the snow bridge 20 metres below me and then the depths below it. The slot, so the crevasse, was probably maybe 10, 15 metres wide. And this roof of ice just seemed to go on forever. But it was probably 15 or 20 metres. And it took me quite a while to work out what was going on. It was much cooler in there. I had a thin layer because the rest had been in my rucksack as we moved fast. And I'd lost my ice axe. And then I realised what had happened was the sheer heat generated in that colossal fall of material had melted the snow and ice in the moment. And so actually it was a molten, a river of water that had flowed. And as it hit the cold air, massed in that huge crevasse, it's in fact the first big crevasse that joins the mountain. We call it the rim eye in French. It froze instantaneously in the moment that I was in midair. And so it was one of those series of circumstances that led me to be hanging like a bat.
I would say it reminds me of Skywalker in Hoth, where the monster stuck him in the roof to eat later on, which is my immediate thoughts.
Well, it's that feeling of, actually being completely powerless because I was suspended in the middle of this roof of ice. I couldn't reach either side. I couldn't touch the bottom. I'd lost my ice axe and I could just follow the trail of a little drip of blood that was coming out of my mouth to the descending towards that snow bridge below. But it was all right. Because I had this really taut 9 millimeters of Kernmantle rope that was stretched tight up through the roof between my feet and then going on to the other two people on my rope. And if I could hear the jangle of the hardware on the harnesses and their voices. So I was pretty happy. I'd been in worse mountaineering situations and far worse operational situations before. And so for me, it was natural that they would follow down the rope and they would come to collect me. Even though they couldn't hear me as much as I shouted for a good part of 45 minutes. That seemed obvious because I was just being, if you like, cushioned. The sound was being bounced back by this wall of ice.
An interesting place to be. And the bit where, actually, you know, very critically, that is the lifeline to the surface that's there. And knowing that they're on the other end of that.
It was not only a physical connection. It was an emotional connection. It's like a mountaineer's rope is I suppose a bit like children and cans and a string. It's that tremors through. It's a real sense of rooted connection. And so the team literally bound together. So that piece of 9mm of nylon is so important because it just makes you feel still held, if you like, by the team. And so I wasn't that worried. I knew that there would be other things to do. I didn't know what had happened up the top. And I imagine they might be trying to dig out other people. And then something happened that completely changed that situation. And simply that taut line of rope went slack and then fell through the little hole that it had in that roof of ice.
Yeah.
Whacked me on the nose and then lay plumb straight down below me, hanging off my harness. And when I pulled it up and examined it, the rope had been clean cut by a knife.
It wasn't eroded or abraded. And so...
No, this hadn't come from friction from an edge.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's no rock up on the glacier anyway. But no, this had been clean cut by a knife. And we only cut a line when that individual is now becoming a hazard to the other members of that team. Mm-hmm. Or in this case, where they felt that I was probably... dead anyway.
Yeah.
And what had happened was the climber above me had been killed, Zach Speakman, and my body was pulling with his body, the third person, and they were trying to recover that body whilst it was being secured and anchored by the third person on that rope. So they cut it, presuming that I was probably not alive anyway, and they would come to me later. And if I was, it wouldn't have made any difference.
Wow. That account reminds me of Joe Simpson's experience in South America in that similar situation. That, you know, that's a pretty full, you know, first story, and you could summarize that, and you've explained part of it is this is a survival situation, that it's that bit of me or him, and if I don't cut it, then it's me that's going in that situation. So we can sort of understand that local rationality of how does it make sense for that. But that's, you know, a little bit in hindsight and your experience that's helped explain that. What was going through your head at that stage then?
The picture, which had led me to be reasonably content, knowing that everything would be fine, I would be plucked out at some point, was now irrevocably changed. Mm-hmm. And for the first time, probably in my life, I felt that I'd been forsaken. Mm-hmm. And that is not something I'd ever experienced before, as in I was entirely alone, not by choice. This wasn't a solo venture.
Yeah.
And worse still, I was alone because people had thought that in all probability, I probably wasn't alive like the climber above me, because they felt that the crevasse was actually filled with debris and I was underneath it. So I couldn't possibly have survived. And that meant that I, for the first time, gave up. And I've never given up before. Mm-hmm. I just decided enough is enough. And I allowed myself to relax and just waited for the inevitable.
Yeah. Which I'm just thinking of the sort of the deep military ethos of, you know, even more so in the States, but leave no man behind. But it's that team bit that basically I will do that. And I'm really intrigued, and we'll probably come on to it, is if the rope was able to run so freely, it's really weird from my perspective as to why that wasn't tested to see if there was a response from your side. And hopefully we'll come on to that sort of, but that's my first thought was if it runs that quickly and easily when it's been cut, did you ever find out whether or not they tested to see if you were there or because there was a person in between and that's what the issue was?
Well, I think the difficulty in that case was because my feet were welded into that ice, as it were, that the rope wasn't taking anything like the full weight. It was taking some tension, but of course the body will produce the same tension. And because and the other thing to sort of be really notable on any kind of glacier is the amount of friction involved when ropes move through ice is it's not the same as if it was free hanging. And so it would have been really hard to discern. And as much as I was shouting that everything was muffled and they would have looked for a number of meters every side. And it looked like, of course, that it had just been filled in by the avalanche. So there would just be tons of debris over me in the way that it was over the climber above me. In fact, his was a big block of ice. So I think that was why it just would have been really hard to. And it was not. What I did find, it wasn't that they said I would be dead, but if I was alive, I was going to remain alive. Yeah. But right now, in the moment, that was pulling the other body off, and they couldn't effect a good rescue of Zach's body, or that there was obviously a third person attached to that rope as well.
And that's, you know, a lot of what we talk about in the podcast is understanding that rationality, and it's digging into those stories. So you're here, and you didn't give up. What happened? What turned that around from what you just said is being alone and giving up to actually, you know, a very powerful story to be able to account to people?
But it was the strangest of things, really. It wasn't a flashback of my life running in cinematic technicolor, like perhaps you see on movies. But as I drifted in out of consciousness, I think my core temperature dropped down to about 31, 32 degrees. So I really was really just semi-conscious.
Not having sort of brain hemorrhaging as well from being suspended upside down for such a long time as well.
Huge pressure and lesions on my lung. I had some light lung damage and some fractured ribs. I was swept back, if you like, into a moment. And it's a moment that I remember start in terms of that recall with me with my head in my hands, sitting on a polypropylene chair in this, well, say bombed out, but it was a heavily distressed room in this location that myself and my company had been defending against insurgent attack for weeks. And I was lost in the moment in real reverie. I don't know how long it was. It probably felt like hours. I suspect it was probably 20 minutes. It could have been 30 or 40. All I do know is that moment of being completely lost and without thought and without any awareness of what was around me was broken by a great big hand coming onto my shoulder. And as I looked around, I saw it was my company sergeant major. So if you like, my senior warrant officer and in to all intents and purposes, my second in command. And it was Dale Norman. And he just looked at me and he went, "You're coming with me." And he lifted me physically by my chest webbing out of that seat and propelled me out of the room and then pretty much ran me down the stairs on the outside of the building just because of sniper fire and all the rest, and pretty much kicked me into this little sort of sandbagged area, which was our shower block. And what I hadn't realised was the reason I'd been lost in that moment is I just had sent the final signals confirming the death of one of our soldiers, one of my recce platoon soldiers called Chris Raymond, a soldier who was really close to all of us and very close to my heart. He'd even visited my house when I'd taken kayaking and climbing. And I'd been involved in the team. We did about 45 minutes worth of CPR and even an improvised tracheotomy. And the blood of that young soldier was across the front of my uniform. And I was completely and totally unaware of this. And so when I came out of the shower, Dale just handed me his one spare set of uniform. We only had one on, if we're lucky, one in our rucksacks, because we had to be able to evacuate this location at a moment's notice. And then after I put this on, I came out and he literally just held me as I cried for however long it was, 10 minutes or 20 minutes. And then what I do remember is then he pushed me away at a moment when it was clear that I had the solace that I needed and was able to begin to come back into the moment. And he looked me straight in the eyes and he said, "You told us that as your leaders, you must be prepared to ask for help. You must allow those around you to share the leadership. And you must be prepared to be vulnerable. And the one time I could help you, you did not allow me to do that. And I will never forgive you for that. But it's the last time this happens, do you understand?" And it was the courage of that man in that moment when things were really busy. We were under siege for 3 weeks. We fought solidly for 16 weeks. He had the self-possession to understand what was really needed by his boss. And he did it in a way that was completely unequivocal. This is not ambiguous. This is not a conversation. "You let me down by not allowing me to support you, and I won't accept that." And it was the robust level of courageous kindness that knocked the sticks in that memory. And it was that moment where I went, "Today's not the day," because of moments and people like that, because of that strength of kindness, today is not the day I die. And it just was invigorating. It was like being filled with a sense of purpose. And I managed to do a little half crunch, if you like, take an ice screw off my belt, put that into the roof above me, and then tie off that cut piece of rope just enough to relieve my chest. And then, whether it's an hour or 2 hours later, a patrol of the Gendarme de Montagne actually found me following rope partly, but also a bit by accident because they were looking for another party below, and I was pulled out. But that was the moment. It was this recollection of this kindness without compromise, at a time when it'd be all too easy to have been too busy to see what the boss needed, to go that there's people out there who care that deeply. So I'm not giving up.
It's a really, I mean, obviously a very, very powerful story about what's, how you've described that. But I'm interested in some of the language that you used, almost that sort of dichotomous language of courageous kindness. And you sit there and go, and in the middle of a war zone where everything is going wrong, and the ability to say, I'm going to look after you, and I'm going to look after you because I care, not because I have to. And I think, you know, I've never been in situations like that. I spent 25 years in the Air Force. I spent 10 years on a squadron, and I certainly miss the closeness when going away on detachments. And you were a five-man crew, six-man crew with a couple of servicing engineers, and you would just get stuff done. And that sense of achievement, and I'm going to say brotherhood of, we can do that. And the memories that, you know, I've got a whole bunch of friends here in Malmesbury. We can just go on a beer call and just talk about stuff. And then you go, that was 20 years ago. And it's the stories that happen as if they happened just now. And I think, you know, the view of how somebody might take a combat zone and sit there and go, here's the first story. Oh yeah, well, it's like bing, 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 video gaming. When actually the reality is, it's survival, and it's survival by looking out for each other and caring for each other. And the heartbreak when the injuries and deaths happen that just never gets lost, but can be pulled right back at the time that you've just described now as the most critical piece that says, you know what, the bit about pull yourself up by your bootstraps and sort your life out because there are people out there who care.
I always firmly believe that for us to maintain our humanity in during acts which are by their very nature barbaric, which is close quarter fighting, the day we leave kindness behind, and that includes the day we desensitize ourselves to the enemy to the point that they are no longer people, mm-hmm. is the day that we walk away shells of ourselves, if not worse. My commanders all knew that my single most important thing, as far as I believe culturally, was I would rather people hurt a little bit more when they pull triggers. And perhaps sometimes that meant that there might have even been delays, but they were responsible and responsive to what they were doing. So they maintained their humanity so they could still be assimilated back into society when we returned. And it means that level of kindness and care is non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. And in every moment, no one can be too busy to be kind. And that's a deep-seated level of compassion, which enables the ordinary to achieve the extraordinary in extraordinary circumstances. Because the sheer reality of things is most of us, people are just normal, but there's nothing, we're not special forces. I was just combat infantryman, just happened to be a company commander. And so there's nothing different other than our training and preparation, but mindset is very different. And it reminds me of David Gilbert Smith, who was a troop commander in the SAS during Korea and went on to command the training wing at Hereford, the home of the SAS. And his definition of leadership, which he brought forward into the Leadership Trust, a trust he founded to export the understanding from special operations into global leadership, was that it is that use one's personal presence to win the hearts and minds of those around you in order to achieve common purpose. So this idea of a presence that is so real, so connecting, and so filled with empathy, but also courage and discipline, that it is unwavering. and knowing you're part of that, and that's the description you made of a family that is insoluble, allows you to go forward on the darkest of moments with some confidence, because that confidence is born from that connection with those around you.
And I'd be really interested to hear how you have found trying to bring this into the corporate space. Talk about being a leadership coach and lecturing at universities. One of my connections who I've done some, I presented to when they were at an early part of their master's, their thesis was about trying to bring mission command into the corporate sector. And their sort of the outcome, one of their sort of research findings was, unless you've experienced it, it's really difficult to do. And it requires a massive amount of investment from an organization. And I not challenge, but I questioned David Marquette the other day on LinkedIn, with this bit about give authority down. And it works in the military because the military invests in its teams to give them the technical competence to achieve those goals. But if an organization doesn't invest in its junior subordinates, whatever, the people lower down in the organization, if it doesn't give them the confidence and the competence to achieve that goal, by just delegating, actually you're abdicating and you're not getting stuff done. So really interesting, this is way off on what we'd normally do for this thing, but it's a really important piece is, so how do you bring that into the corporate space? Because I'd love to know.
So David Marquette's book and his Marvelous Iris Animate piece that was done. Of course, so many people go, I want some of that. And lots of consultants in my space, of course, that's they love that. It's money's coming in and I'll come in. It does not work unless you have the culture that is based on an utter freedom of authority through this idea of clarity of purpose. And also, we forget that when a young recruit joins any of the three services, when a young officer joins any of the three officer training academies, from the moment they start, we talk mission command. We talk the mission-led approach. And it's not new. It was first published in 1856 by the Prussians. And so suddenly we go, oh, well, we'll run a two-day program. And they wonder why it doesn't work. Because SADAS is a year, and then your specialist training could be anything from 6 months to 2 years on. A corporal's course, a lance corporal, it's 10 to 15 weeks. Your junior staff corps, your intermediate staff course is a year. There's all this. We spend multiple months going on years in training where this is touched on, and people wonder why it doesn't work. And it doesn't work until we divest ourselves of a couple of things. And that's why I won't talk mission-led approach until we got the other things in place. Is people, very understandably, in civilian organizations are promoted because of their technical proficiency, because they're recruited on that basis. It has to be that way. And they get to a point where suddenly they've got people that they are now responsible for, either as direct reports or they're leading in some sense. And now they're a leader and they get a title, they get a band, they get a grade. They've often had little or no preparation, but all they know is in their minds, credibility comes from being the biggest brain in the room. That's just, it's conditioned. It's nothing, there's no bad apples, it's bad apples.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's what get people, and the financial compensation is based on your position in the organization.
So until people get used to your sole job is to make the other 5, 10, 15, 300,000 people the brightest brains in the room at the moment when they, when it is their moment, if you like. Yeah. You don't get it. And of course, that is really hard for people, because that means also not only encouraging people saying, I don't know, but also accepting that you might not have the best answer. Yes. And in fact, in all probability, you don't. You may have some ideas, but the refinement comes. And the other one is decision making. By definition, if you're making all decisions, you're too slow for the operational cycle, whatever you're in, your market, doesn't matter. And so getting used to a rough decision on time with people nearest to the activity will always result in an initiative will allow you to be preloaded and therefore ready to take advantage. Mm-hmm. And so I always laugh when people say, yeah, well, we went on a course, we did a bit of this, we understood that, we saw David's video, or we read the book, or we read the Stephen Bungay stuff. Yeah. And then we put it in, and over 3 months, nothing's happened. You go, what do you mean? But where's the safety? Where's the sense of challenge? And the other one's, when are you asking people to do this? Oh, so you're not accepting any reduction in performance temporarily as people completely change the way they do things, let go of everything while spending time on defining purpose and boundaries. Because by definition, when you make a major change, there will be a blip. But you expect, so clearly, it's going to be half-assed. Yeah. So if you really want to do it, what's your pain point, if you like? Yeah. And then let's have a talk. But let's have a talk about what the psychological safety really is. And of course, that at the heart of it is, are you perceived as kind? Because that's what we respond to the most, because that breeds trust, creativity, and a propensity to take risk, appropriate risk. It's a very different conversation, but a lot of that is my environment. So consultants saying, yeah, we can do this for you, because it's part of the zeitgeist, but without really having the serious conversation with clients saying, you do understand what this will take.
Yeah.
I'm not used to hear that.
No. I recently had, actually, it was an ex-army guy now working with an NHS trust and contacted me. And my first question was, is this an underspend in the year? Or are you looking for an 18-month, two-year program? And actually, in fairness, he said, this is a long-term program. And I went, okay, fine. I will start.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, it's so frustrating when you sit there and go, right, we'll do this. Oh, it's a couple of days. Right, okay. So, it's the consultant's holy grail is, how do you find those people who've got that mindset? And that's also the hard piece. You know, there are those who get it, but they don't have authority and they don't have a budget. And they don't have a leader who, you know, their boss that believes in it.
It doesn't work without space. It doesn't work without individuals' ability to create a sense of space at key moments to just ensure, is this a moment to let go? And how will I delegate that with an idea of a real clarity of purpose, that unification of activity and an appropriate level of decision-making authority with the resources to back up those decisions. Because that's the other thing that a lot of organisations do. We say, well, we let them come up with a plan, but we don't give them resources. Well, that's not mission command. Mission command is you decide and you do. Otherwise, all you're doing is listening to ideas. You're still making the decision. That's not freedom. People won't respond to that.
And that also requires the bit they were saying is they've got to have the competence to be able to do that. And if that means you've got to grow them, fine. But it's that bit of, well, crack on. It's like, but I don't have the technical knowledge. Well, that's your problem. Okay. So, and you know, just the discussions here of how and why things fail in the way they do. So things like change, and I had Anne Stowe on a little while ago talking about buyouts. Mergers and why they fail, and just because of the inability to communicate and understand the constraints and the limitations that exist. And you've just described that in terms of, hey, let's develop a leadership program. Let's make this happen. And I, you know, whenever I go somewhere, I say, look, I feel very privileged that in the 25 years I did in, I probably had a year plus of dedicated leadership training. And you know, as a multi-crew aircraft, we were there operating as a team all the time, and we would operate as formations. And I did something a little while ago with a media company, and they would go off and do these shoots. They bring camera people in, they bring the talent, they bring the directors, all from different, they're all, you know, a lot of them are freelancers. And they said, it's just a mess when we arrive. It's like, okay, so how's about putting some orders together? When you arrive, have an in-brief. And it's like, yeah, but we've got loads of people that do this. What do you think the military does? They, you know, they train, yes, but they bring strangers together to be able to operate cohesively and collaboratively to achieve that goal. And there's a whole bunch of process that helps that. It doesn't magic up. It requires a knowledge of how to do that and an investment to make it work. And it's like, oh, it sounds like too much like hard work. So the
biggest singular failure, even in organisations that are really, really keen in terms of giving resource, space, and the time it takes to create, mission command's a mindset. There are tools and processes, but it's cultural. it's failing to see how critical the back brief is. Mm-hmm. And so the biggest issue is normally, right, I'm going to delegate. So I am going to describe to you what you're going to do and say, right, now within that box, that's up to you, now go away. And then people, of course, the leader gets worried because they, in their mind, they don't know what's going on. And the individual is never quite sure whether the leader is actually approving what's happening. And of course, the fail-safe in the middle, it is not organized chaos. There are moments where you have the authority decisions made. That's absolutely right. It's just done. And then we talk about what happens later, particularly when they're simple or they're really hot. But most of the time, what happens is that person, well, it's not a person, it's a group, the organization, the grouping, as we would call it, wouldn't we? We come back together and they back brief the senior leader. This is, as we understand it, your intention, the purpose behind the intention. And this is what we believe is the situation and the limits of authority. And with this in mind, this is the plan that we propose to execute. And this is how we propose to do it with the resources we have. And sometimes we'd like a bit more, that enables us to do this. And there might be some argy-bargy, but it's not, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to ask you some questions to check you've been listening to me. Now, where you go, it's I'm going to sit and you are going to brief me on your plan, which is effectively my plan. And that's the first thing.
I've told this, the box to play in and where to go to make it happen.
So for me, it's getting people onto the dance floor. So normally, if we're all hanging around the bar because no one's quite got the gumption, there will be a track which we either agree or we just look at each other. But we know that if somebody had come before and said, right, I'm going to choreograph each of you. And if I'm happy that your dance moves are up to my standard, I'll let you on. And by the way, I'm going to take you to a 2 meter by 2 meter square. You can only dance here and I'll place you. That's going to be one hell of a
crack. But I'm going to choose the music too.
Yeah, exactly. My favorite track. But we go, oh, this is the one. And we move together, normally in a space that causes least hazard to everybody else. And people are able to freestyle. And that's at the heart of Mission Command, is it's coming onto a tune that is really clear to all of us, that brings us together in a defined space so that there are limits of authority, but within it, allowing people to freestyle as much as is appropriate. And that's what gives speed and expeditious effects in operationally uncertain, ambiguous times. And of course, we do it naturally in a nightclub, but because of the ways, as you said, we reward and how we promote, and also our focus on technical CPD and training rather than leadership as a whole raft of things in itself, is that people are not equipped for that. And so it's often not the leaders, even the organisation, failing to understand the size of the task, and actually where it needs to start is, do people truly feel safe to challenge, to speak their mind? And also, do leaders feel safe to say, I don't know? Yeah. And can they say that at board level to the CEO? Can the CEO say that to the chair? Is it because it just rolls across and down? Unless people don't feel that permission. Now, clearly, there's times when you damn well should know. You accept, but there's a lot of times when you go, I know the situation, but I don't have a direct answer. I will have an answer by tomorrow, for instance. And it's that. And it's really hard unless that is present. And it has to start with those stages of psychological safety. And only then can you build upon that freedom of action, which flows from the idea of Mission Command. The other one is accepting there's no such thing as a perfect plan. It's always a dirty plan. So just get on with it.
It's messy. There's always going to be gaps. There's a couple of bits there. Just you'd mentioned that, going back to your story in the sort of combat area, of the ability for a junior member of the team or, you know, subordinate to sit there and go, boss, what the fuck is going on? And grip that. And I'm just thinking, how many times would you see anything like that happen in a corporate space? And I think that is how much care and trust and compassion and kindness exist in the corporate space versus the environment you've just described.
Well, I think so it flows from this idea of tough empathy, which was came really from American military and emergency services and was sort of framed in the HBR article from 2000, Goffey and Jones, Why Should Anyone Be Led By You? And this idea of, I will look after you in a way that's perhaps not even reasonable to expect. So I'm going to go far, far beyond, if you like, my paper line of responsibility to look after you as a human being. But here are my standards. And these are standards of our organisation, and they're not for negotiation. So We operate excellence, and I will give you the excellence of empathic, connected care. And with that then comes is, well, if I to maintain that standards, there must be a freedom to challenge. And this idea of people don't understand, they absolutely do understand when to challenge and they understand when not. It's quite intuitive. And if you have the right environment, they'll do it. And so there would have been certainly more than one occasion where a four-day plan that I put together for an ambush or whatever it might have been, we're an hour into the op on the ground, a long way from any kind of help. And a 19-year-old sniper comes up and says, boss, basically the plan is shit. It's, you know, what it's predicated on is on the, I'm looking at the ground. That is not going to work. And the answer is send the plan as if it was mine. Everyone listen, this is the plan. And that level of confidence that where it needs to be, that's how it works, only comes from spending time drinking more tea. So just having that level of bonded understanding with each other, which comes to conversations without an agenda, not talking at people. And that creates that mutual trust where I trust that I'm going to make decisions. And sometimes they go wrong, but the boss will always have my back. And as the boss, you go, well, I trust they will always make decisions based on their knowledge of my intent. And that knowledge of intent is, of course, the foundation stone of the idea of a mission-led approach.
Thank you. This is not what, we said beforehand, where's the conversation going to go? I don't know. These conversations are complex and emergent, and we'll see where they go. So, Justin, thank you very much for sharing your time. The final bit is a recommendation of a book, a paper, a video, or something that you found really powerful that's helped you grow that you would share to somebody else. And we'll put that in the show notes. And it doesn't have to be one. It can be multiple, book and a film or whatever. So go for it. What would you recommend people consume?
Right. Okay. So at the moment, I would say you want to start with anything by Nancy Klein. A Time to Think is the classic. This idea of thinking partnerships, space, listening with intent and creating that space, allowing people to take their minds for a walk. I would then Professor Michael West. So the King's Fund, he has a video about compassionate leadership, but also has a book on compassionate leadership as well. So Professor Michael West's work, really, really interesting stuff. I suppose the other thing I would take me is it doesn't matter really where it is, but I go to Rosalinda Torres's three questions, which she gleaned from working with Fortune 50 CEOs in the States, working out what made senior leaders fit for the 21st century. And she looks at those who are considered to be successful in the way that they led by their own people as much as by the markets themselves, if arguably more about the people that they interacted with. And she came up with three questions, and I think they're really useful for all of us. And again, so Rosalinda Torres, Future Leaders of the 21st Century, I think it is a TED Talk, brilliant, is where are you looking to anticipate the future? Which is a really interesting one. So what are you reading? What are you looking at? How are you trying to extend your interactions, your connections beyond the normal and the comfortable? What are you reading? Literature. It doesn't have to be, a fact, non-literary books. The second question is, what is the diversity metric of your professional and social network? In other words, if you talk of good inclusion at work, and work is quite inclusive, but you have a totally one-dimensional personal network, well, what does that say? Because that's restrictive in your ability to see different perspectives. So it's so how broad, how challenging, how different are the people you choose to spend time with? And then the third, which is perhaps the most apposite for so many of us, is what will you jettison from the past that got you here to get you there? In other words, what's been really useful up until now, it's not a bad thing, but now there is probably not the space. So what are you going to get rid of so you can really embrace the new? And of course, it's normally quite a big list, but she starts with one. And those three questions for me are questions I go back to. And I suppose the very last one would be, I can't have a conversation without referring to my time spent with indigenous people, is is the Cognacs. So they the former headhunters for Nagaland in Northeast India, who have this concept of Matkapu, which is standing for the truth of things. And so for me, as a person, are you really sure what is the truth that you have chosen to stand for as an individual and as the organizations that you are part of? Will you recognize your soul in the dark, was what John Amici's mother said to him when he proposed he would become a professional basketball player. It's that same idea. And all these things, of course, they don't work by algorithm. There isn't a nice app and there isn't a self-help book from the airport. It requires reflection and it will be messy and muddled and difficult. And I think that's the point.
Absolutely. You know, I do have a coach and I coach others, and the reflection and the journaling and the wrestling with identity is a big thing. So thank you for those recommendations, Justin, and thank you for your time this evening.
Fantastic, Gareth. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you.